headache is that we are actually living on the event horizon of a black hole. And we are a holographic projection of a universe existing at the event horizon of a black hole. That strikes me as bizarre. But there are physicists out there who patently push that theory. And, you know, it's one of those things that you can't disprove yet. So, you know, we're all just a bunch of holograms. There are other guys out there who think we're just computer simulations in some alien computer.
That would be a la The Matrix. Now I'm going to make your migraine headache even worse. If we are living on the event horizon and we're just a projection of the universe, are we a projection of what's inside the black hole or outside the black hole?
I would think that it's a projection from the inside of the black hole, simply because the event horizon has a bunch of characteristics. There's Hawking radiation, which is basically just a black body radiation temperature and such. So that goes into the concept of information theory. There's a fundamental theory in quantum mechanics that information cannot be completely destroyed. It can be shredded and blocked and hidden, but it cannot be fundamentally destroyed. If you drop something into a black hole, unfortunately, for most people, that means that information is pretty much gone. You've destroyed it. So what other people say is that everything you throw into the black hole is reflected back at the event horizon, and that's how the information is saved from destruction. So go figure.
Well, I remember reading something many, many years ago that suggests that although conceptually black holes cannot, nothing can get out of a black hole, they nonetheless do radiate energy, and that as a result, they ultimately will shrink out of existence.
That's Hawking radiation. It's interesting in that the smaller the black hole, the faster it does that. So micro black holes would last an instant and evaporate, whereas massive black holes like the one in the center of our galaxy would take a trillion years to evaporate. It's interesting how you would think it would be the other way around. If it was bigger, it would be radiating a lot more, and smaller, radiating a lot less. But relatively speaking, it seems to be the exact opposite. And the reason why Hawking radiation works, unfortunately, there's two sets of answers. If you read the popular articles, you will get a meaningless bit of dribble. There's some kind of explanation where virtual particles come into existence all the time, which they do. Then the idea is when a virtual pair of particles come into existence at the event horizon, sometimes one will fall into the black hole and the other one will shoot out in the opposite direction. And somehow the thing that gets swallowed by the black hole, the virtual particle, will decrease the mass of the black hole, which to me makes absolutely no sense. There's another theory which Hawking actually promoted in his papers, which unfortunately requires quantum gravity, which is a very, very soft, squishy field that no one's been able to really do much with. There's a very special case in the way of Hawking radiation where he gets away with using quantum gravity, but otherwise that's about as far as it goes. But yeah, that Hawking radiation is what's going on, and black holes do have a finite life. Their mass is slowly bleeded away as a black body radiation.
If I may, perhaps the black hole is one end of a wormhole, and the other end of the wormhole is, for lack of a better term, a white sink where matter is being created. So it's not that it's being destroyed by entering the black hole. It's just being repositioned somewhere.
Usually when I've heard this described, they just use the same thing. They say it's a white hole. It's interesting, and it's symmetrical, and mathematicians especially love symmetries. Physicists tend to love symmetries as well. That's why they were really into the concept of the Big Bang before we realized that we were just speeding up the acceleration. The idea was that the universe would just slow down and then form a big crunch, and then that would be followed by another Big Bang, and it would be cyclical and symmetrical, and it would go on forever and ever. But unfortunately, the universe had other ideas. I've heard the story, and it's fine. The only trouble is that although we've been able to kind of detect black holes, we haven't detected anything that comes close to the concept of a white hole. And when people plug in numbers as far as wormholes, which is very good for science fiction, but the trouble is with wormholes is that they're theoretical constructs that have an opening that's smaller than a proton. In order to keep it open wide enough to do anything with it, you would have to use a lot of whatever negative energy might mean. But that's the way the equation works. You would have to throw a lot of negative energy at a wormhole to open it up and stabilize it. So it sounds like wormholes might be the same thing as tachyons. Wonderful mathematical constructs that have very little to do with reality. But who knows? They make great science fiction, though.
Corey?
Pitch. I just want to make sure Harry's done.
Yeah, the only other thing that I was toying with is another thought that I read years and years ago, and that is the suggestion that there may be an alternate, parallel, other universe coexisting with ours where the speed of light is the slowest that anything can go.
Hey, that's an interesting one. I'm not that familiar with that particular version. There is the many Earths theory many universes, the multiverse theory, multiple parallel universes that sort of go on their merry way. That since there's an infinite number of them, that there's infinite versions of us doing infinite versions of things. That would sort of, your premise would be that would be kind of a tachyon universe, because that's the whole concept. Tachyons have this very, very absurd, one second, I have to kill my audio. I'll be right back. Okay, this should work. I'm sorry about that. My computer hiccuped and the audio did a strange thing. Anyway. Tachyons. Tachyons are very strange things. They travel only at the speed of light, they travel at an infinite speed. And as you place more and more energy into them, you can slow them down so that they can approach the speed of light from the other direction. If they have any non-zero rest mass, you can never get them slow enough to be the speed of light. They're always running faster than the speed of light. So they're interesting particles on a theoretical basis, but again, I don't think that's going to pan out.
Unless that's where the white hole dumps matter and turns it into tachyons in that alternate reality. Who knows? It's all very head exploding.
Once you introduce parallel universes, then you could make the case for almost anything, because when someone tells you that you can't find it anyplace, you just tell them because it's not here, it's over there. Physics is intriguing. Some of it kind of makes sense to me. Some of it makes no sense whatsoever to me. And there are so many different theories available. It's kind of like the old comment about if you get two Jewish guys together, I can tell this story because I'm Jewish, you'll get three opinions. If you get two theoretical physicists, you'll get at least 15 different suggestions for how the universe began. Okay, Richie, you wanted to ask me something?
Richie?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Richie, you wanted to ask a separate question, right?
Correctly. Is Professor Hawking still alive, or did he pass away? I haven't heard anything more about him. I fear the worst. He had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. He was probably the best mind, or is the best mind, since Einstein.
Yes, unfortunately, a matter of fact, I did that story last year on the Science Talk. He passed away. He suffered from a variant of Lou Gehrig's disease because most people don't make it to that age, even with the fastidious medical care that he received. So fortunately, he kind of fooled everyone. They didn't quite know that he had a variant, so they didn't really give him a great deal of time. So I don't know. I mean, if someone told me I only had 3 or 4 years to live when I was in my 20s, I don't think I would think of physics grad school as the way of spending those last 3 years. But thankfully for the world, he did that. And he made many discoveries. He was a brilliant man. He was probably better at mathematics than Einstein was. Einstein was a big thought type of a guy, but he needed help with mathematics. Hawking's was equally adept at both, and he's come about as close as we've been able to come to concepts as quantum gravity, which is one of the big new things that one of these days someone's going to win a Nobel Prize for. His loss was noted, and it's a shame, but that's the nature of life, unfortunately.
Yes. I know he was unusually... He survived an unusually long time. I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, he had a successful career. He was able to publish a lot of papers and do a lot of things and change a lot of minds, and so he will not be forgotten. So, Wesley, I believe you wanted to ask a question.
Yeah, you just triggered me to think about electric field and magnetic field. And in the course of that, I'm going to implement the electric and lines of the electric field. So first I'm going to read you a statement. Let me drop. What is the difference between electric field and magnetic field? And the statement is, there is no difference. There is only one electromagnetic field. What you call electric and magnetic field depends on reference frame, and it is rather splitting in electric and magnetic components of this field, like you split your space-time vector to reference frame in one temporal and three spatial components. Do you agree with that?
I thought I kind of mentioned that when I was doing my thing. Electrical engineers and electrodynamics, classical electrodynamics, sort of got the idea that there was maybe something missing. There's a lot of literature on four-dimensional tensors, versions of Maxwell's equations and such, and there's a lot of that written before even Einstein wrote about relativity. But I tend to agree with that statement that magnetic fields and electric fields are two sides of the same coin, based only on your frame of reference when you're measuring things.
So now I'm going to take the opposite position just to have the discussion more interesting. So I say no. Electromagnetism is the conjugate forces of the electric or dielectric and magnetic fields of conductor. Or what we have. What you say is true, then we could switch the visualization of the magnetic and electric fields fairly according to reference point, and we cannot. Let me drop. The electric field lines terminate on charged object particles or and never connect. And magnetic field lines are concentric circles that always connect. And now I'm going to talk about dielectricity. Dielectricity and magnetism, however, are more like two separate and distinct parts of whole, like male and female. So we can have dielectricity with magnetism, just like without magnetism, just like we can have magnetism without the dielectricity. But they are almost seen together. Do you object to that?
Again, it's sort of like the electromagnetic version of saying that you could write an equation for an ellipse that is basically a straight line. You could also write an equation for something that everyone would recognize as an ellipse that would be a perfect circle. But that doesn't mean that a straight line is ellipse, and that both things that are very different are basically ends of the spectrum of what is an ellipse. So I don't know exactly. You can anything that acts as a linear equation can be separated into components, and that is what people have done to make life easier, because using tensors that include both the electric and magnetic fields as one thing is a big pain in the backside mathematics. So it has been simplified over the last century or so by separating the components into their electric and magnetic equations. But fundamentally, the reason why Maxwell's equations are basically magnetism and electrical fields and electromagnetism is because it's a kind of artificial construct to separate the two for simplicity's sake, when the fundamental force is both of them at the same instant, but just different aspects of that.
Do you familiar with the concept of the electric lines of force of statements?
I don't know what you're alluding to in dielectric lines of force, because what's the forces? They're not dielectric forces. What forces are they?
When you're trying to represent the electric field in a circuit, you can use the statements lines of force, and they are the electric lines of force as well. You have electric field lines of force, and you have a dielectric field of force. That's why I ask you about it. Statements, you can look at it later. All lines of magnetic force are closed up on themselves, and all dielectric lines of force terminate on conductors, but may be in the form of closed loops in the electromagnetic radiation. Let me drop. And this is how we represent the basic laws of lines of force. It can be seen from those laws that any line of force can just end in space. But I'm going to come back to the subject. Magnetic fields are created by the movement of charged particles in the circuit. The magnetism created by those charged particles, usually electrons, is the same magnetism created by a normal magnet at your home. The magnetism in your home magnet comes from alignment of the atoms, so when they are aligned correctly, the tiny magnetic fields of an atom created by electrons outside of nucleus adds up and make large one outside. And that would be like introductory to whatever is next happening in electrical circuit. Do you agree with that?
Like I said way back at the beginning of all this, any charged particle traveling at a constant velocity, either linearly in the way of a circuit or angularly, like the spin of an electron, will produce a magnetic field.
Well, what I think is that magnetism is in electric circuits is created by the movement of electrons in within the circuit, and is quite similar to that what I explained before. So since electrons can affect magnetic fields can also affect electrons, and this is the part of the of the mechanism that I was trying to draw with words. Electrostatic fields are different. Let me drop. They are, so the electrostatic fields are straight lines with only terminate on other charged bodies. They are like lines of longitude. Well, you could see it on a map. Do you agree with that?
Not quite sure what you're trying to get at tonight. I really don't. As I said, if you take a charged particle like an electron and you apply a current on a piece of wire, you're moving it at a constant velocity. You are producing then a magnetic field. If you move a magnetic field through past wire, you will induce a electrical current. I'm not quite sure exactly what you're trying to get at.
Well, we started from the difference between electric field and magnetic field, and we tried to put them in the spatial perspective, or XYZ, or whatever the spatial format you use for it. But then we came to the electric field. And then we came to lines of electric fields, and we say, well, I don't know if I know what you're talking about. And then I mentioned Stamets. So my question to you, what is that the electric field arises from? And to XGS.
I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to. I'm assuming that these lines you're talking about are lines of electrical field flux. But I'm not quite sure. Dielectrics is interesting, I guess, if you want to talk about how capacitors work and such. It's kind of classical electrodynamics, I think, that you're discussing, and I sort of was discussing something a little bit in the relativistic area.
So, where is the electric field coming from? Is there any dielectric field?
An electric field is a static field with a proximity of a charged particle somewhere around. That's an electrostatic or electric field. If you alter the field, if you change the field, you end up inducing other things. If you take the electric field and you move it at a velocity, you induce a magnetic field. If you take a magnetic field and induce a velocity for it, you produce an electric field. Again, not quite sure where we're going.
Dielectric field, not electric field. Does dielectric field exist? Do you have a line of dielectric field? And what is the origin of dielectric field? How it arises?
I do not know. I would assume that a dielectric field is an electric field occurring in a dielectric material, but that would just be what I would think it would be. Might be wrong on this. Again, you know, dielectric fields is kind of out there, at least in the stuff that I'm reading, but okay.
The dielectric field arises from the charged particles. when you wrap two objects together, whether it would be insulating objects or conducting one, the electrons from the insulator move to the conductor, causing two objects to be charged. And because the electrons are negatively charged and there are more electrons than protons, positively charged particles on the conductor, a negative electric charge exists on the conductor. So the opposite it would be true for the insulator, and positive charge exists because the electrons are lost from the insulator, mean that protons have more room to manifest their energy in the form of field. We're talking about a charge. So when, let me drop. And that happened when the electromagnetic field, or the field that arises when both dielectric and magnetic fields are in conjugation, which is happening most of the time, that is what Stamets called electric field of circuit. But in order to come to arrive to the electric field, we had to start from the dielectric one and the mechanism that is behind it. Stamets is spelled STEINMETZ, and to exist.
I'm familiar with Steinmetz. Not that I read a lot of stuff from the 1800s, but I don't know where you're going to. You're kind of now discussing electrostatics, and that you can use friction on dielectric insulating materials and dislodge electrons off of one, cause a charge difference, and so you have a local charge inequality in different things. You know, people kind of will take a balloon and rub it against their hair and put it on the wall, and it sticks due to static electricity. I I'm not quite sure where we're going.
Well, I'm just discussing electricity and matter. We started from, what is the difference between electric field and magnetic field? We went to a dielectric field, and then we got stuck because we couldn't get on the same platform with lines of the electric field. That's why Stamets came in. But I believe it takes too much time for the net for me to get to conclusion of it. Let's leave it for now, and to exit.
Okay, very well, Wesley. Anyone else with any questions or comments before I move on to the next story?
KD2NVP.
Bob.
Yes, Roy, just very quick. Way back, somebody recommended a relativity book. I have another relativity book recommendation, which I can't vouch for firsthand because I just got it. I haven't had a chance to read more in about 5 pages. But it's by the same author as Thinking Physics, Lewis Carroll Epstein. It's called Relativity Visualized. I think all you guys, you, Dick, and Paul, all have that other book, Thinking Physics, and it's an excellent book. And this looks also like an excellent explanation of relativity, and a lot of reviewers say the same. So I'm just throwing that out there. It's called Relativity Visualized by Lewis Carroll Epstein. Back to you, Roy.
Hey, very good. Thank you very much, Bob. I mean, there was a time where I was considering whether I should include book reviews as part of this. Maybe I should rethink that idea. But thank you very much, Bob. I'll take a gander at it. I always like to see different interpretations. Because, you know, people use all kinds of interesting metaphors, although, you know, you could read the Einstein's own book on the subject, which is pretty good. But it's surprising how clever people can come up with metaphors that kind of make it seem like you understand a little bit better what's going on.
Very good. I just want to add that I got it from Amazon. I got a used copy. I'm suspecting it's out of print, but I don't know for sure. But the current price on a new one is something ridiculous like $60. But you can get used copies on Amazon for a very reasonable price. So back to you, Roy.
I personally don't mind if it's not chewed on. Getting used books on Amazon is not a bad idea at all. Sometimes you can get a pretty good deal. Matter of fact, I was listening to an archive of the Technical Net back in 2010, where Silent Key Mel, K2KEY, was doing a discussion of all things on how to calculate complex impedances using the Pythagorean theorem. And he was citing this book he had on mathematical equations for electronics. And it sounded so interesting that I went to Amazon and got myself my own copy of the thing. So it's always, sometimes books fall out of print, unfortunately, but that doesn't mean that they're not worth it. So thanks for giving us that heads up there.
Very good. Thank you, Roy. Back to Ned.
One more call out. Anyone have any questions or comments before I move on to the next story, which will not include any relativity? Some people will be very happy to hear. Okay. Scientists have created something of a reverse solar cell in a way, a tool that generates electricity from the darkness of night itself. Scientists are desperately trying to harness energy from whatever untapped sources they can get. They were able to generate enough electricity to power an LED using apparently $30 in equipment thanks to something called radiative cooling. The idea is that the amount of power coming in from the sun has to be approximately equal to the amount going out from the Earth as thermal radiation. So in order to keep the Earth at a roughly constant temperature, that has to happen. In their paper published in Joule, the researchers point out that 1.3 billion people lack reliable access to electricity, and though solar cells exist, these communities require lighting at night and the need for battery storage from solar panels to use the energy drives up costs. Instead, the researchers devise a means to create electricity at night on the spot. Solar panels commonly generate electricity from the sun through a physical process called the photovoltaic effect, but others work through thermal processes. The sun is hotter, the earth is cooler, and the difference in temperature can be converted into usable energy. The researchers devised a system based on an alternative process in which the earth is the source of the heat. Now, the system is made from 20 centimeters, that's 8 inches to us Americans, aluminum disc painted black and hooked up to a commercial thermoelectricity generator. These discs are radiation emitters and are typically several degrees cooler than the ambient air. Heat flows from Earth into the air and then from the air through the thermoelectricity generators into the disc, which then radiates the heat upwards. The test in California was able to generate an entire 25 milliwatts per square meter of the disc, enough to power one small LED during the daytime. The device could act in reverse, absorbing sunlight and producing electricity from heat traveling from the sun to the disk and into the outside environment. Let me drop for a sec. This, of course, is just a proof of concept. With more insulation and in more optimal conditions, like a drier climate, the researchers think they'll be able to bring this up to an entire half a watt per square meter of disk. The authors of this article suggested that with larger disks, they might be able to light a home continuously. But I tend to think that this would require a rather massive black painted disk to accomplish such a feat. Well, this isn't really comparable to solar energy, which can generate maybe 100 times more power than this particular device at its limit, according to the study author. And an assistant professor of material science and engineering at the University of California, Los Angeles, but it is cheap and would be able to be operated for longer than a battery could. And, of course, it provides a way to generate electricity at a time that solar panels can't. It's a clever twist of an old idea of a heat pump that right now is powering my little drinking bird toy on my desktop today, but I question whether the cost-performance index for such a device will ever make the implementation particularly feasible. Well, Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2.
Yes. WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Isn't this a variant of the thermocouple effect? You know, where you take they have them on spacecraft. And you'll take the heat of the sun and the coolness of the dark side of the spacecraft. In some cases, they have the thermal couples there, and they generate electricity that way. Back you were.
Yeah, Paul. Basically, it's the same kind of concept, just a much cheaper version. And the strange idea of reversing the direction when the sun goes down, the idea, I guess, being that if it was in space, that you would then couple the heat source to be the ship and somehow connect it to the outside cold of space. But it's basically the same concept, but done for $30 instead of NASA. Probably it cost them $1 million.
And also maybe the reverse of the Peltier effect. You know, it was like a refrigerator. You know, maybe it's on that type of an idea as well. Except in reverse.
Peltier effects are solid state based. They're very inefficient. I've seen more than a few guys try and use Peltier effect devices to cool their personal computers, and what ends up happening is ones that really are functional produce their own heat signature a great deal. So the problem is getting rid of the Peltier's excess heat. Otherwise, its efficiency drops. But I think that they go with much simpler things. Peltier devices can be relatively inexpensive, but that's for very low-efficient, low-power versions. So they probably just use over-the-counter type of equipment to squeeze out a couple of ergs of energy. Fundamentally, it's a heat engine. Heat engines have been available for 150 years. A heat engine is the mechanism for the little drinking bird gadget that Einstein was fascinated with when he first saw it. You get a little glass of water, and as long as you keep the beak wet, what goes on is evaporation at the beak cools the top of the bird, and the thermal difference between the bottom and the cooling top from evaporation drives the drinking bird. So it's a heat pump. It's a very simple concept, and probably can be done for $30 or something close to it. I don't know whether a half of a watt is going to get anyone that thrilled for a rather large device, because you're going to need rather large devices to get much power out of things like that.
I guess if you had a bigger heat, more heat on one side and cooler on the other would help. Might work up in Iceland, where they have a thermal effect.
It's my understanding they use that geothermal effect to extract power, and it's very useful. But that kind of limits you to very particular places. Those are few and far between. The idea of these people, I gather, is to electrify a lot of the third world countries that don't have this.
Okay, well, they got a long way to go. All they're going to get is one LED out of it, but it's something.
Yeah, it's worth a paper, and I guess it's worth an effort. I've read all kinds of very screwball ways of illuminating the inside of houses from places that don't have electricity that kind of amounts to punching a hole in the roof and putting water in a bottle and use it as a poor man's magnifying lens. So I don't know. It's not as screwy as that. So it'll be interesting to see if anything comes of it. Right now, the only thing it came to was a paper, which is very important for an assistant professor to get published. Okay, on to funny or disturbing story. The New Zealand Health and Disability Commissioner has admonished an acupuncturist for going way, way too deep. This past Monday, the commissioner, Anthony Hill, released a report determining that the practitioner breached the Health and Disabilities Consumer Rights Code when she turned her client's lung into a pincushion. According to the report, the client was receiving treatment for an injury on her left wrist and arm. The acupuncturist stuck two pins in the unnamed woman's pressure points at the top of both of her shoulders. The client mentioned that the needles felt extremely deep, and a half hour later, the practitioner removed the needles and the client experienced something she described as a sudden onset of right-sided chest pain and shortness of breath. The client then began to experience air sensations around both lungs, which is not supposed to happen. The acupuncturist reportedly told the patient to rest off the pain, but when the woman laid down at home, she noticed her right chest felt numb and her left chest hurt. So her husband took her to a medical clinic, which referred her to an emergency room, where she was diagnosed with a collapsed lung. The acupuncturist told the authorities that she told the client that collapsed lungs was a slight risk for this needle placement. However, the client told the same authorities that the practitioner did not tell her that the needles would be close to her lungs or that the placement could cause an injury. Let me drop for a sec. Commissioner Hill sided with the patient and decided that the acupuncturist breached the health code by not properly informing her clients of the risk and not obtaining written consent prior to sticking needles into her body. Hill recommended the acupuncturist undergo more acupuncture training and have the auditors determine if she is giving clients proper information and obtaining consent, and should then show the HDC the results of the audit and proof of continuing education. So only goes to show, acupuncture can do nasty things to your lungs. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. NASA has ensured the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico can continue its search for near-Earth objects that pose a threat to the planet with a $19 million grant. The fund was awarded to the University of Central Florida, which operates the observatory on behalf of the National Science Foundation. Asteroids that are predicted to come within 5 million miles of the Earth are considered a potential threat by NASA. While that seems like a vast distance, gravity could shift an asteroid's orbit closer and closer to the Earth, eventually resulting in an impact. A proactive approach is certainly preferred for this type of work, and the Earth evidently needs more eyes watching out for such threats. Just last month, an asteroid dubbed a city killer that we spoke about here on Fast Science Talk took scientists by surprise. Traveling at 15 miles per second, the giant space rock, designated as Asteroid 2019-OK, missed Earth by just 45,000 miles. To put that into perspective, as we've talked before, the moon is about 240,000 miles away from us. Let me drop for a sec. The Arecibo Observatory will also analyze and categorize near-Earth objects to help inform future space mining and sampling missions. Quote, we can use our system to constrain the size, shape, mass, spin state, composition, binarity, trajectory, and gravitational and surface environments of near-Earth objects, and this will help NASA to determine potential targets for future missions, a principal investigator for the observatory's planetary radar program said. A portion of the $19 million grant will also be used for a STEM education program at the Science, Technology, and Research Academy in Puerto Rico. 30 high schoolers per semester will learn about the science and research conducted at the observatory across 16 sessions. The 1,000-foot radio telescope has been in service since the 1960s, having served a variety of uses from determining the rotation period of Mercury to transmitting a bitmap image to hypothetical extraterrestrials 25,000 light-years away. The faculty facility has occasionally faced financial troubles, but this latest grant will keep Arecibo Observatory running for the time being. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, next one's a rather serious one. The number of people stricken by acute lung disease linked to e-cigarettes continues to grow, with nearly 500 suspected cases reported across the United States as of a few weeks ago, along with two more deaths in Oregon and Indiana. But while the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and others are still saying there are multiple reasons why these products could be hurting people, health officials in New York have pointed to one ingredient in particular, vitamin E oil. In a press conference a few weeks ago, CDC officials provided an update on the situation. There were 450 suspected or confirmed cases across 33 states reported to the CDC. In Wisconsin, the first state to report the cluster back in July, there have been 34 confirmed cases, with an additional 12 being investigated. Illinois, with 49 currently confirmed or suspected cases, was the first state to report a death likely linked to vaping. Health officials in Oregon reported that a middle-aged man with a severe respiratory disease linked to vaping succumbed to his injuries in July. And another death was reported by Indiana officials. Yet another death possibly related to vaping is also being investigated, according to the CDC. The condition still has no official name, but the CDC has created a standard guideline definition for doctors to diagnose and report cases. Sufferers are said to be experiencing worsening symptoms like cough, fatigue, and trouble breathing in the days and weeks following vaping, while some have stomach issues like vomiting and diarrhea. Nearly all of the victims have been hospitalized, sometimes for weeks at a time, and some have been have had ongoing heart and lung problems even after treatment. In many cases, their lungs also has evidence of lipid pneumonia, a type of inflammation linked to inhaling oil. Let me drop for a second. In its briefing a few weeks ago, CDC officials again stressed these cases aren't tied to a single e-cigarette product or ingredient, but a majority of victims have reported using products containing THC, such as waxes and oils that are heated and inhaled. Often people have bought these products off the black market rather than through legal vape shops. These products have included counterfeit versions of cannabis containing e-cigarettes available in some states where recreational cannabis is legal. A few weeks ago, the New York State Department of Health announced an update on its own investigation, stating that the officials had detected vitamin E acetate, an oily compound, form of vitamin commonly used in skin creams or supplements, in nearly all of their samples of products containing cannabis or THC that had been used by sick patients. The agency said vitamin E would now be a key focus of this investigation. Also, the Washington Post reported that the Food and Drug Administration had found vitamin E in the THC-containing products taken from patients across the country. According to Sven Erik Jont, a Duke University researcher who's been studying the potential harms of nicotine vaping, vitamin E has never turned up in the regular nicotine products that he or other researchers had studied. Nor does vitamin E appear to have been found in any of the local nicotine-based cigarettes taken from patients. Let me talk for a second. That means there's little research on how vitamin E could affect our lungs when heated and inhaled, but there's definitely a reason to think its effect on the lung could be disastrous, even if it's safe to apply on our skin. If inhaled at sufficient amounts, it could certainly cause respiratory problems, maybe even lipid pneumonia, a lung inflammation associated with inhalation of oils. It is an antioxidant and may burn and disintegrate when heated in an e-cigarette. E-cigarette releasing toxic agents. What's unclear at this point, though, is exactly why vitamin E is in these products. Jornt noted that some vitamin E is naturally found in cannabis, so there's a chance the compound can be found in the largely unadulterated cannabis oil that many vaping products use. But on the other hand, it is entirely possible that the illegal products contained added vitamin E acetate to increase volume or dissolve the THC better, or that skincare oil was mixed in. For example, there are many skincare oils marketed online that contain vitamin E ester and other oils in addition. There are still many unanswered questions, so black market products are now a common link between patients, but there are a minority of sickened people who reportedly use only nicotine products. In Oregon, in the Oregon death, the patient did report using cannabis oil, but it was purchased from a legal vape shop. One major problem is that e-cigarette liquids could contain such a large number of ingredients, especially if it's illicitly made. We're still barely scratching the surface of how these chemicals interact with one another in our lungs. Let me drop for a sec. Jordan pointed out that some companies billing themselves as the healthy alternative to nicotine vaping are selling e-cigarettes that explicitly let people vape vitamins, including vitamin E. Neither the CDC nor other health agencies have implicated these kinds of products in the illness cluster. But regardless, it'll take a long time before we can be sure what any of these products can do to your health. In the meantime, the CDC has one clear piece of advice. Avoid buying any vaping products sold through the black markets, including online. The FDA, just this past Monday, issued a warning to Juul over its marketing practices and accused the company of claiming that e-cigarettes were less harmful than traditional cigarettes, a claim that the company has not been authorized to make. The agency also slammed the company over an incident in which Juul representatives visited the classroom and told kids that Juul was totally safe. In a statement, acting FDA Commissioner Ned Sharpless said that the spike in the youth use of e-cigarettes continues to climb, especially through the use of flavors that appeal to kids that make that are more aggressive action. Let me drop for a sec. Last week, Michigan became the first state to ban the sale of flavored e-cigarettes, citing a rise of use among youth. In a statement at the time, the governor accused tobacco companies of using candy flavors to hook children on nicotine and misleading claims to promote the belief that these symptoms are safe. In June, San Francisco banned the sale of e-cigarettes, becoming the first major city in the United States to do so. The Trump administration has recently announced that the Food and Drug Administration is considering yanking all non-tobacco flavored e-cigarettes from the market. So keep that in mind if you have any grandchildren, children, what have you, that vape. It can be very dangerous. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, it's coming up to 10:59, so I think that I am going to let Paul do his space report. I just want to once again remind everyone that if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, the best way to get them to him, if you can't come on the TechNet, is to email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. That's mailbag at, my call sign is AlphaCharlie2GulfSierra.com. And all these stories and more, the video of relativistic electromagnetism and such will be available on my website, which is roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, thanks to everyone who participated tonight, and thanks for Dick and Paul for giving me the opportunity. So I'll pass it back to Dick so that he could pass it over to Paul for the space report.
Thank you, Roy. Good material. And how tough do you think the puzzle is going to be next week that you're going to come up with? So, Roy, go ahead.
I think it's going to be tougher for me than for you guys because I don't have a clue yet.
I understand. You made it up as you go along. Okay. Paul, what's going on in space? And that let's see now, I'm trying to remember which country it was that was landing a craft on the moon, and it went dead within a few feet of the moon, like it's probably crash landed. I think that's maybe last week's report. WS2N, K2RW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, that's the Chandrayaan 2 spacecraft, you know, it had the orbiter and the lander and the rover from India. So it was India's second orbital spacecraft for the moon. They did one back in, 2008. So, you know, over 10 years now. So that was their last orbital mission for the moon. They have a spacecraft in orbit around Mars presently that's operating, called MOM. But yeah, this one got very close. The orbiter is still functioning, and the lander made it down to around 2.8 kilometers from the moon's surface, and they lost contact. And they still don't know if it crashed or if it landed, and they really don't know. And the orbiter has taken pictures. But what's strange is India, mission control isn't giving up the information of what they see. So we have the LRO, it's called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. We've had up there for over 10 years in orbit around the moon, in polar orbit. And it does all this high quality photography of the moon. And, you know, that's the spacecraft that's been able to actually see the footprints of the astronauts on the moon. So NASA is going to use that to photograph the area. They know the exact area where Chandrayaan 2 was supposed to land. And down near the South Pole. So I think once they get that, we'll be able to see real pictures. And they'll confirm whether or not it crashed or it landed, or maybe maybe it's on a side. We just don't know. They also have one of those corner reflector gadgets on there, similar to what the original Apollo astronauts left on the moon. If you shine a light from any direction, it will come back to that direction that it was shined at. And they have that on that one, and they have their... The LRO has the ability to shine some kind of light in that direction to see if it comes back and hits that spacecraft. So we'll find out as the it's the second failure of a country. Israel tried to do it back in April, and they came very close to it. What I heard with Israel was the Bereshit lander was facing in the wrong direction when the descent, one of the engines fired. It was supposed to actually be facing 180 degrees the other way, so they think it crashed into the moon around 500 miles per hour. So we'll have to get better luck with the future landers. We have quite a few that are getting ready to go within a year or two. From this country, and from private companies, they'll get rides on spacecraft like the Falcon 9 or something. So my guess is India will try for a Chandrayaan 3. I don't think they're going to give up. It's all done in house. They launch their own rockets. They have their own heavy lift rocket. They have the medium lift rocket. They just recently developed a light load rocket as well. It hasn't flown yet. And this one launched on the large one, the global satellite launch vehicle, GSLV they call it. And hopefully they'll make it next time. But their orbiter is doing good, and they have, I think, 9 different scientific instruments on that. So they'll get science back from that. It's not a total loss. It only cost them, I think they said, $130 million, our money. So they really kept the cost down. You know, if NASA was going to do that, it'd probably be five times the price. I don't know that, but you know the way it is. Let's see. There was one launch that was supposed to go up last week from Japan, and it's the HTV number 8. That's a cargo vehicle going to the International Space Station. Launched on a H2.